rated M for mature.
Welcome to the Lost Pages of Norse Myth. I'm Jason Weiser, your narrator and host of the Myths and Legends podcast. Each month, join us here as we reveal a missing page from the Prose Edda, the great book that contains all of Norse myth. It's whispered that these lost pages tell the story of a god from a distant land and his young son as they embark on a perilous journey across the Norse realms. But before we begin, I have an exciting announcement for God of War fans and collectors alike. Sony Interactive Entertainment and Santa Monica Studio have partnered with Loot Crate to create the God of War Limited Edition Crate. It's packed with exclusive collectibles and more to take you deeper into the rich world of God of War. Check it out at Loot Crate's website. Pre-order before May 31st, 2018, and you'll also receive a bonus Challenge Coin keychain. Supplies are limited, so pre-order today at lootcrate.com/God of War. Now back to your regularly scheduled epic adventure. I present to you now the 8th Lost Page, The First Great War. His vision blurred in between the blackouts. When he was conscious, his senses were overwhelming. Too much was happening all at once, and it all blended together in fits of pain. All his tortured mind allowed him to process was the loud pop and crackle of the fire as it consumed him. A terrible cacophony overpowered only by the cackling of the Aesir gods, who laughed as his body burned. His name was Freyr, a revered leader of the Vanir. He had traveled to this foreign land as an act of diplomacy. Trying to form a truce, he taught the Aesir the ways of the harvest. He gave these gods abilities beyond their wildest dreams, with spellcraft fit to feed all of Asgard. But such powerful magic always had a downside. And when things went wrong, the denizens of Asgard weren't about to blame themselves. His head nodded back up, and through the smoke he saw Sif, Bregi, and Hodur among the other Aesir gods in the crowd. "You brought this upon yourself," one of them chided him. "You'll burn among your poisoned crops." He didn't see who was taunting him. It didn't matter. Only days ago, they were willing pupils for his lessons. Now, they could hardly even stay seated, drunk on mead and cheering ever louder as he became engulfed in the flames started by the very crops he had enchanted. Though the pain was great, he knew he would survive. Freyr sighed, and finally, mercifully, blacked out. Hours later, he awoke to find himself alone in Odin's hall. The cruel gods of Asgard were likely off somewhere celebrating his supposed demise. So, he crawled from the still-burning coals, dusted the ash of the harvest away, and snuck out of Asgard to make his way home. Across the realms in Vanaheim, the Vanir gods were incredulous with anger as they gathered in a seaside longhouse in Noatone to discuss what to do next. Odin's cruel gang had tortured and burned their beloved Freyr. Tensions had been simmering between the Vanir and the Aesir since time itself began, but only now were the two sides finally tipping in a real conflict. And so a war of the gods began. The Aesir, Odin, Thor, Hunir, Hodur, Ve, Vili, and all the rest were merciless in their attacks, but traditional too. They fought with weapons and brute force, as physical combat was the only way they knew. The Vanir used more subtle means of magic. Led by Freyr's sister, Freya, their spells undermined the gods of Asgard at every turn. She used Saethir magic to confuse their warriors into attacking one another, while Freyr reversed his earlier enchantments to truly blight the lands of Asgard. Their father, Njord, channeled his anger into vicious winds that whipped across the sea, causing the Aesir's travel to last nearly twice as long. Skirmishes between these two tribes of gods continued unabated for centuries. Eventually, Odin, the proudest and most cruel of all the Aesir, sought to put an end to it. He was sure it could be settled quickly once his forces were in place, so he gathered a massive army and marched them toward Vanaheim, determined to wipe out the Vanir once and for all. Fear and deference cloaked the landscape as they stomped across it, for the King of Gods had never lost a battle, and he surely never would. The massive throng of troops backed up well past the horizon as they descended in multitudes upon the lush gardens and bountiful fields of Vanaheim. Yet, as these soldiers landed, they were curiously falling back two steps for every advance they made. "We must end their magic," snarled Thor to his brothers in battle. "It may already be too late," replied Heimdall, with his especially impressive vision focused on the front lines. The Aesir hadn't ever encountered so many Vanir gods casting Sather's spells at once. They were unexpectedly formidable in combat, taking the lives of Odin's soldiers at an alarming rate. The Aesir retreated, trying to minimize their losses after several days of hard-fought battle. With heavy damage done on both sides, the warring gods found themselves, once again, stuck in a stalemate. With Vanaheim and Asgard both ravaged, the two stubborn factions saw no way to singular victory. The only thing to consider now left a bitter taste in all of their mouths. Compromise. Mimir was considered a great negotiator by all, so he alone was selected as arbiter, and he brokered a rather brilliant deal. Freya, a leader of the Vanir, would be betrothed to Odin, king of the Aesir. Then, surely, the two would work together for the good of all the realms. Struck by Freya's beauty, Odin readily agreed. But Freya, the strong-willed high goddess of the Vanir, spat at the thought of the proposed accord. Marry this brute? She wouldn't even entertain the idea. Back in her hall, she sat alone, fuming at the thought of marrying such an awful soul. Odin had tried to destroy her home, her family, everything she loved, not to mention attempting to murder her beloved brother. She couldn't even bear to look at the repugnant one-eyed king, and now she was to spend eternity with him? Beyond that, Freya was a revered leader of her people. What would they do without her? And what would she do without them? Here in Vanaheim, she was in charge. In Asgard, she would be bound to the Allfather's increasingly cruel and bizarre whims. After days of agonizing over the wedding that increasingly appeared to be her fate, she eventually considered her resistance to be a bit selfish. Before her was the rare opportunity to unite the realms. What's more, her people would be better off with the deal in place. And so she acquiesced. Still, Freya swore she would never forgive Mimir for using her as a pawn in his negotiations. Even though the bride managed barely a smile through the entire event, the marriage of Odin and Freya meant peace at long last. And that alone was cause for celebration throughout the realms. The Allfather wasn't one to let the opportunity for a party slip by. At his command, it was an opulent ceremony with days of drinking and feasting that none would soon forget. Odin took in his beautiful new wife, bathed in golden candlelight that refracted off her extravagant Vanir jewelry, framing her face in the warm glow. She looked back at him, and for once, with the promise of peace resting behind his curled smile, he didn't seem too vile. At last, after centuries of war, peace rippled across the realms. At first, their marriage was tolerable. She taught her husband Sather spells, which he took to easily. For a time, Freya felt nothing short of truly blessed. Though she missed Vanaheim, she was bestowed with new purpose and felt that her home was here now. However, as she became more content, her new husband only grew less so. The High Vanir goddess went back and forth with herself. Was she expecting too much from Odin? His interest in her waned daily. Perhaps the god of gods was too busy in his grand pursuit of knowledge, but he was also chasing gossip, becoming increasingly paranoid and fixated on the destruction of the giants. Every day, they became further and further estranged. Still, things had been worse before. She could suffer a loveless marriage if it made for peace across the realms. Eventually, Freya resigned that she and the Allfather would simply live separate lives, as she quieted herself in the face of his descent toward madness. The One-Eyed King was infatuated, to say the least, with Ragnarok, the apocalyptic battle said to end the world. "You're ridiculous," Freya would taunt him with her honesty, but even Odin's friends and followers laughed at him when he would talk about the great impending Twilight War. Of course, all the gods knew that the end would come eventually, and, indeed, embraced the certainty. But the conventional wisdom was that Ragnarok was a long ways off. Nevertheless, Odin was manic in his insistence that the end was nigh. He claimed that if he could destroy all of Jotunkind, he could stop the apocalypse. So obsessed was Odin with the destruction of the Jotnar that he decided that conventional means of warfare were simply not enough. He employed the talents of the greatest smiths in the land, the brothers Brock and Sindri, to create for him a weapon of unimaginable destructive power. When it was finished, Odin bestowed the mighty hammer Mjolnir to his son Thor and sent him out to slay every giant he could find. Thor accepted this task with glee, finding Jotun wherever they would roam, interrogating them to locate the entrance to their kingdom, and murdering them, whether they gave up information or not. This genocide was too much for Freya to bear. She could no longer hold her tongue and blade. While her husband exterminated an entire race, she fought back, vowing to leave her husband and return to Vanheim, even if it meant imminent war. But more aberrant than ever, Odin wasn't about to let her have her way. No stranger to sneaking out of the Aesir Kingdom, Freya had nearly reached Asgard's high gates when Odin interrupted her. His voice bellowed, echoing off the protective walls. "Freya, this betrayal aches. We could have saved the realms together. I'll curse you so your spirit breaks and banish you betwixt forever. Please, don't." Freya attempted to plead to her husband's more tender nature, but it, like his sanity, was lost. Odin swiftly cut her off, "To never make harm by your hand, or visit this most holy plain. Forget your home, that lush green land. Finished is your reign." The Allfather, eyes flaming, loomed above her. She stammered, gasping for air, and making every effort to counter with an incantation of her own, but she just couldn't grasp the words. Long ago, when their marriage seemed to have hope, Freya had taught him the ways of Sather. Back then, Odin laughed it off as a lark. Though he was skilled in it, his interest appeared to be solely for patronizing her. The other Aesir gods made fun of him even for that, as magic was considered a less than manly pursuit. Only now was it apparent. Odin had mastered the craft and kept it secret. Now, instead of casting spells, Freya was feeling their twisted effects. Her vision was blurring fast. She stumbled as the nausea set in. She felt warm and tired. And then it all went black. Freya awoke to find herself cast from the realm of Asgard, distraught at this severe penalty. Now, she would never be able to return to the realm of the Aesir gods, or even raise a hand in defense if harm should befall her. And then it hit her. The sadness was rapidly replaced with horror as she realized what would happen next. With Odin more deranged than ever, war would surely return between the Vanir and Aesir. Mimir's great negotiation had fallen apart when the Aesir were even more powerful than ever, thanks to the gift of the Masterwork Hammer from Brock and Sindri. The end of her doomed marriage might indeed mean the end of her people. With her decades of sacrifice all for naught, one thing was certain. Freya had failed to stop the madness of Odin and the Aesir. Her only hope was that, in time, some brave soul would finish what she could not, restoring balance and peace to the realms. The 8th Lost Page has been revealed. Follow God of War on Facebook to learn more about the endless war between the Aesir and the Vanir, the backdrop for Kratos and Atreus' journey through the realms. Keep listening now as we chat with Anthony Demento, Senior Systems Designer, and Luis Sanchez, Lead Level Designer, about exploration in the new God of War.
So to start, would you guys please introduce yourselves and talk about your roles in the game?
My name's Luis Sanchez, and I'm a lead level designer, kind of focusing on exploration. Anthony Demento. I'm a systems designer. I work on everything from progression to quests to exploration content, a little bit of everything.
So what does exploration mean in a game like God of War?
I think exploration means to me quite a few things. So one, for this franchise, is opening up the world and making the world feel bigger and kind of world building and not making it a linear experience and just have the world breathe a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's just things off the beaten path. Like a lot of it to me is choice and like when I do things, what I'm doing, rather than just following the story, you know, what kind of things can I discover that are outside of that kind of critical path.
Yeah, and choice, autonomy. I feel like for me as a player, that's what excites me in games now, kind of modernizing the series and giving players the freedom to kind of, you know, take a break from the story and choose where they want to go.
So is God of War an open world game?
No.
Okay. It is not an open world game.
No, I think what we're doing is, whereas it's not an open world game, but there are hubs. In our instance, one big hub where there's additional content that doesn't necessarily tie in to the main story. It does in certain ways, but it's more about expanding the world and kind of, you know, creating a more immersive experience just outside of that main story.
How does exploring the world for this game feel different than, or how is it different than the previous God of War games?
I think it's really goes back to giving the player that choice. You know, the older God of Wars were like a finely tuned like roller coaster, and you know it was tailored to one experience, taking the players on that, you know, ride. And then now it's different. Like you have that roller coaster in the main story, but you can choose to break off of that and then kind of have your own experiences at your own pace with additional content that also ties into, you know, the entire world.
How do you balance the side quests and the main quests and the different things that don't relate and the things that the player has to do?
It can be a challenge sometimes because there's not like a defined order in which you do mm-hmm. things. So in some cases we had to create an order to it, which is a challenge from a design side. Where we want to tell a story, but when you can do things in any order, you know, there has to be some way to kind of guide players, but still maintaining that choice, which is, like we said, so important with the exploration content. There's also, you know, with God of War, it's different because there's not really friendly NPCs like you would see in like a standard RPG or MMO. So it's finding like who is giving you these quests and, you know, what are their needs? What are the stories they can tell? Why are those stories interesting and how do they tie into the bigger game world?
Yeah, and then I think just from a design standpoint, one thing we found out is we have to present the player with the fork. So clearly kind of telling them like, hey, you know, you've just finished up a chapter, even though we don't have those, you know, spelled out for the player. But somehow telling them that, like, this is a good spot where, like, if you want to, you know, take a break, you can. And here are your two choices.
How do you tell, what are the challenges of telling, like, a coherent story in this sort of format?
Like I said, like in a lot of situations with exploration, we have, like, whole levels of content that mm-hmm. are there. And I think the first challenge we dealt with exploration is what's driving players to this content. Like, is it just purely optional? Like, and if it is, like, what's kind of the point of going there? Am I just going in and doing more of the same that I would find on the critical path, but without that strong narrative that you do find on the critical path? So, like, what's your reason for going there? And I think that's how a lot of, like, the early quests kind of came to be. Was, like, looking at the space a lot of times, because for us, like, in a lot of these situations, the art almost came first, so we would look at the space and say, okay, like, what is this place to us? Like, what could it have been? What was it in this world that we've created? What happened here before? And actually, like, telling, like, a much deeper backstory than you might even get when you're playing the game and letting that inform the story we're going to tell. Like, I can think of one level in particular we were looking at and we were just like, well, what could this be? Like, it could have been a prison. It could have been a storeroom. It could have been, like, a collector's, you know, museum almost, and like finding out what fits best, but also makes sense with what the artist was creating when he built it, and then coming up with a story for why you're going there. What are you getting there? Like, who needs it? Why do they need it? What are they going to make you with it? Which is the other thing that I think is really important with this content is what's your reward? As a player, like, if I'm not interested in the story, and there are some people like that, like is there some sort of progression carrot we can dangle, something that makes Kratos stronger or Atreus stronger, or just kind of pushes you forward, gives you new things to do, new ways to do it.
How do you lure players away from the main storyline and into this, some of these side quests?
Mm.
So I think our main avenue we found was the shopkeepers, which are Brock and Sindri.
Yeah, the Holdra dwarves.
Yeah, the dwarves. And so kind of funneling all of the quests through them, because they have big personalities and they want to help you and they craft different items for you. So that was kind of the carrot that we dangled on the player. It was like, well, if you go do stuff for these guys, they're going to reward you and give you new gear.
Some of that just kind of like made sense, right? Like you have these two dwarven blacksmiths that, you know, what could dwarven blacksmiths do? Okay, they could make you gear. Like I think some of the bigger challenges, like I think a lot of the game and the narrative was laid out before the exploration team kind of came together. So like we had to take things that already had like a strong narrative road paved ahead of it and then figured out how to build these things into it. So we knew we wanted to craft stuff. We knew we wanted, you know, armor sets and upgrades and things like that. So, you know, how do we work these two guys who are, you know, they have their own narrative path as well. How do we work them into quest givers, give them their own kind of side stories and motivations and things they need, and how to make that fit within the story that's already planning on being told. But I think a lot of it worked out pretty nicely. And
then we also got opportunities to kind of expand in our universe. So like one of the levels, for example, revolves around a golem, one of our big rock enemies. And through working on a side quest, we kind of told a little origin story about that enemy. And it became a soul eater. And it just gave that enemy some personality. And it was really cool, like watching that whole thing play out and giving kind of a narrative background and building the world, you know.
It was cool too. Like in that same quest, like there's you're kind of looking for one of Brock's friends, a dwarf with a green wing. And we knew we were going to have like certain upgrades in this game, talismans, things you can equip that give you perks and bonuses and change your play style. But then taking what we established in the narrative there, this ring, and actually turning it into one of those kind of upgradable items. So now you have an item that's doing something for you in terms of gameplay, but now it actually has this like narrative backstory. There's something meaningful about it, right? It's rather than just calling it like Trinket of Odin or whatever, it now has this kind of backstory that we've established through the side content. It means something more to you, which I think is always kind of cool.
And then I think, you know, just to kind of taking a step back, like looking at all the things that go into a side quest where it's like, you know, there's a combat, there's a narrative hook, there's a progression. All of that stuff makes for strong content. And I think the goal is to like not have the side content feel any different from the main content and still have that high production value that, you know, Santa Monica is known for.
Does it usually work like that, having the narrative first and then the exploration? Or do they usually work in conjunction? Or I just don't know. I'm just
I think it depends. I'm just here earlier in this project, so I think maybe we got ahead of it in a lot of ways. But it was kind of par for the course for me. I think, you know, maybe next game, you know, when we know, I think a lot of it, too, exploration became much bigger than we ever planned for it to be from the outset. I think we were looking at like maybe adding like an additional 5 to 10 hours of content, and then it became like a lot more. I mean, just putting like together a list of all like the quests and side content we have yesterday, I went over and talked to Luis, was like, wow, we actually have like a ton of stuff to do, which is really exciting. Like it just became a lot bigger than we thought, which is like one of my favorite parts of working here in general. Is just like the quality of what we're working on is always the most important thing. So if you have a good idea or something that you think is going to make the game better, the studio and the leadership here is always very eager to let you do that and let you explore that. And yeah, our own exploration into exploration turned it into a much bigger and more robust experience.
Yeah, I mean, everybody here, like, it's just a tremendous studio with a lot of talent. And I think the number one thing for me is, like, everyone's, like, really passionate about the project and what they do. And we have a lot of specialized roles. Mm-hmm. And then you can just talk to someone and be like, hey, I was thinking this system should work this way. And then I have full confidence that they'll just run with it and I don't have to worry about it. And then I can focus on, you know, my discipline, which is great.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's like a really good point. Like I said, it is one of the best parts about working here is even when you bring some of these ideas to someone in another department, you know, a lot of times they'll take that, they'll run with it, they'll put their own spin on it, they'll add something to it, whether that's narrative or art.
Do you guys work with the writers of the main narrative to kind of strike a similar tone, or?
So the writing group, they have someone that's just on exploration.
Okay.
But that person works with the main writer, the two main writers, and they kind of make sure that tonally it all like feels the same. But it's good to have like one person that's our point of contact for exploration.
Yeah, I think when you're doing side quests, like, and I think we established this really early on, there needs to be a lot of close communication between, you know, the systems or quest designer and myself, the narrative people writing this, and in our case, the level designer who's kind of creating the space where all this stuff is going to be. And I think for our process, you know, Luis and I started with the narrative team of sitting down and saying, like, okay, like, what do we need from these spaces? Like, what do we need to kind of make these interesting, drive people to it? Starting there, and then establishing some archetypes, right? Like, so we don't have too much of one thing. Like, not everything can be a fetch quest, or not everything can just be like, hey, go kill these five guys over there, or whatever. So making sure, you know, there's a variety of things to do that serves the content, but then also told an interesting story. And sometimes, like, one thing would kind of be the start of it. Like, sometimes it was a really good narrative idea, and then we'd figure out how does that service the area, and then where should we put it? Other times it was like, well, we have a really good idea for like a gameplay element, and that would kind of be the seed that the quest sprouted from. So I think that collaboration between, you know, the three departments and even further with art and animation and everybody is what makes this stuff strong. With any game development thing, it takes a team effort, and I'd say that's certainly the case for exploration.
But it's a very organic process.
Yeah,
iterate on it and just kind of try things. And then I think on our team, because we're not heavily tied down to any like storyline, we're like with the critical path, we have a little more freedom to try things out and kind of, it's more malleable, which is cool.
Yeah. And I think Corey's been, he's given us a lot of freedom too.
Yeah, where, definitely.
Like, I think early on, like, because like we were saying, that narrative, a lot of it was established where we thought, well, maybe we'll be tied down, we won't have as much freedom, but like almost everything we've kind of put in front of him, like, he'll put his own spin on it and he'll give feedback, of course, but he's kind of let us run with it and do our thing, which has been pretty great.
Yeah, but yeah, he's great. He I really like him as a director, and like the story he's created for the main storyline is awesome. And then with the stuff that we propose, he's always kind of pushing, you know, the writers, especially in us, to like make it more interesting and have it be at the same level as the critical path stuff.
So I think what's important about Corey too is this game's so big that like for guys like us who are down in the trenches, like it's hard for us to see that whole big picture all the time. You know, like I've talked a lot about the narrative, but at the same time, like I don't know every beat. I don't know exactly how everything plays out. So when we have an idea, Corey does know, like he does have that full scope of the game. So when we bring something up, he knows enough, of course, as director to be like, well, that's too similar to this. Let's tweak it this way. Or this would actually tie in really nicely with this other moment in the game that happens earlier on. Let's push this back. Let's tweak this. And now it all kind of ties together. And I think those are the things that get him excited as a director, is like, how does this side content tie in with the world? Because like we're saying, you know, with exploration, you want to create this world that you want to be in, that you can kind of get lost in and be immersed in. And the more everything ties together, I think the stronger that is.
So you mentioned like fetch quests and the like. Are there things that people will find familiar, like former God of War players, or things that people will find surprising?
I think a lot of this game is very vastly different than everything or anything God of War has done before. Of course, there's that core, right? The combat, Kratos, the world, the mythology is familiar, but there's so much we're doing that is different, and that's in a good way. I'm not saying that anything with past God of War was bad. It's just an evolution of where games are going these days with more progression, and especially, you know, we're going from what old God of War was, you know, 10, 15-hour experience to something, you know, double or more of that. I think, too, like, with the narrative, like, Kratos in the early games, he was just kind of a rage monster. Like, he didn't have a lot of sympathy for other people. So when you're introducing quests that are inherently helping someone, I think it's kind of cool in the narrative now where you have Atreus, right, who is this counterbalance to Kratos, where there's some lines I really enjoy with the quest where this guy's like, hey, can you help me with this? And one in particular, Kratos just goes, no. And the kid's like, dad, like, come on, like, let's help this guy. Like, he's almost like kind of pushing Kratos to be a better person. And I think that's a strong part of this story and this game in general, is seeing this character evolve from what we know, what we've seen for, you know, 10 plus years of this character. He's different now. He's growing. He's maturing. And part of that is his son. And I think that's my favorite part of the narrative with the quest, is just Kratos teaching the son lessons and then the son teaching Kratos lessons as well.
How do you approach it differently from a game with just a single character exploring? Because is it more challenging from like to design the exploration parts, or is it more fun, or is it just give you more options?
I think it just gives us more options, and it is easier for us to create the narrative because of everything Anthony just said. We're like, now Kratos has someone else that he cares for and someone else to kind of talk to and bounce off of. It just makes it easier, especially with a younger character like Atreus, where he's got the childlike wonder of like, whoa, look at this place. Let's go look over there. Dad, come on. He's just genuinely excited to explore this world. And, you know, Kratos being dad, like, he's going to go along with it.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it makes it any more difficult. I think on a game-by-game basis, you look at your main character's motivations. Where, you know, maybe you could say it would be easier in a game where your main character, his job is to go out and hunt monsters and stuff. So, I mean, that's his motivation. For us, like, Kratos' motivation is to get stronger, to be able to handle these challenges. But it's also that father and son relationship. So it's just a different motivation. And then you kind of write to that. You're still going out and doing things and playing the game just for different reasons as a main character.
Yeah, I think for another thing to note for exploration and all the side quests that we built, a lot of the foundation was built around father and son gameplay and building that bond between them and almost tackling of like, well, what's the purpose of this quest? Like, what is Kratos going to teach his son, or vice versa? What is Atreus going to teach Kratos?
Yeah, so, I think the narrative's evolved with that in mind in a lot of places. I feel like almost all the quests have some sort of lesson, like a specific lesson that Kratos is trying to teach the son, whether it's managing his expectations or anything like that. And at the same time, like, I mean, I know as a huge God of War fan, before I even came to the studio, we're trying to do some throwbacks to stuff that's happened in the game's past. Like, anywhere we can sprinkle that stuff in, I think is great.
Like, definitely, yeah. I think there is a lot of fan service in what we're doing. And there are callbacks to different games, and then just even themes from the past, you know, that father-son relationship, because Kratos, you know, is a son too, and his father is Zeus, and we kind of call back to things that have happened to Kratos and allude to things that have happened, and kind of knowing what happens, you know, Kratos knowing what happens between him and his father,
right,
and the fears that might happen with him and his son.
Man, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I think Corey is like, he's been pretty open about his own experience becoming a father has factored heavily into some of the writing in this game. And if you think about, you know, being a parent, you're going to teach your child based on your own experiences. So, like, we have to go back to that well. We have to look at who our character is and what he's been through. I mean, this is a guy who went from a Spartan general who killed his own family and to someone who learned he was a god and killed his own father. Like, we can't just throw all that out the window, you know? Like, these are things that are informing his decisions and the lessons that he's teaching to his son, not to repeat his same mistakes. And to be better. I mean, it wasn't that like in The Hunt at the mm-hmm. beginning where he's like, don't be sorry, be better. And, you know, how do you teach someone to be better? Learn from the mistakes you made. So, I mean, that's what I enjoy with the narrative, not just in the side content, but the whole game.
Were there any sort of side quests that were especially interesting to develop? Or ones that you're especially proud of?
It's tough to kind of pick one and single it out.
There's
something I really
a lot
like.
Of like, so little moments I feel like that are really good and I'm really proud of. Like the Soul Eater too in the Valender Mines. Like that was cool, kind of proof of concept of like, you know, the side content has to be on par with the main content. It has to have the narrative side of it. It has to have the cinematic aspect to it. So I think that was... I'm pretty proud of that moment as well.
Yeah. I think I'm probably most proud of like the breadth of the side content because like I'm someone who enjoys story, but we have guys on the team, like more gameplay focused guys who just, we have guys who will play a game on mute, you know, and like, but there's stuff for them too. There's stuff like, you know, I can just go there and do something and get a reward for it. And there's, you know, it's still cool and fun. And then there's stuff for me that, you know, is a good story. There's going to play on your emotions a little bit. And, you know, there's stuff that kind of ties together and tells a whole story. And then I think another thing I'm particularly happy about is, like, the first exploration level we ever did was this space called Hail to the King. Well, at least that's what we called it at the time. Just kind of testing out what exploration would be in that game, in our game. A lot of times things like that won't stick, but I mean, it's something that's evolved over time thanks to the hard work of a lot of different people, and it's still in the game, and it culminates like an entire quest line for us in a really cool way that, you know, it means a lot to me just because I've been looking at it for like almost 3 years now and seen it grow and evolve. And as a developer, like when you work on, you know, we put so much of ourselves into these games that like when they come out, like that's my favorite part is putting the game in and seeing like all of your team's hard work kind of pay off. And when I look at that level, like that's what I see. It's just like years of our lives that we spent kind of making this game and how far we've come, and you know, makes it worth it.
Yeah, that level that Anthony's talking about, it's a very wide open area and it's got this big valley in it. So there's a lot of height difference and it's very open. You come out and then there's this big vista where like, you're up top on the valley, kind of looking down into it. Super picturesque and grand. There's a few spaces that we have like that in exploration where they're just big, wide open areas. And those are something that I'm proud of. And kind of how we were able to like tailor and kind of mold those spaces into really cool experiences for the player and kind of give the player that sense of freedom, but also at the same time guide them through the whole level.
You mentioned that this game was bigger than the previous games. Like, how long is this game and like how does that relate to previous games?
It's bigger than I think any of us expected it to be.
And that goes for both the exploration and the main content. Like I feel like both of those have turned out bigger than we thought they would be.
Mm-hmm. And I think what's exciting for us, like where we're at right now with letting people play test the game and see it, is a lot of these spaces we created that are meant to like be a place you can kind of lose yourself for a while. You know, you never know with that. Like, are people just going to go and check it out and leave? Or are they going to kind of hang out there for like 4 or 5 hours? And we've seen through the playtest, like guys are sinking a lot of hours into a lot of these spaces, which is great. I mean, it means they're enjoying the content. You know, they like the core enough to go and do the optional stuff. They want to keep playing. And that was really a goal with exploration too. It's like, if you like the game, you want to keep the lifespan going beyond that, you know, whatever the story ends up clocking in at, whether it's 10, 20 hours, like there is more and it's not just tacked on. It's more within the world and it's new and it's exciting. And, seeing guys kind of sink that amount of time into these extra levels it's a good feeling.
I think that's key, just kind of reiterating that it's not tacked on. It's not an afterthought. You know, there's a whole team dedicated to this and it's a lot of work went into kind of weaving this whole thing together, you know, with the rest of the game and making it all feel like one experience.
You mentioned like fetch quests and like what types of different quests or different actions can people send on? Can you send players on?
Yeah.
I don't know if that's too much of like a look behind the curtain, but
no, I think that's great.
That I've always been interested.
So one thing Sony Santa Monica, being a Sony studio, affords us is this like a lot of other sister studios where we can have some knowledge share. And I think that's been super beneficial to us as a whole and to exploration in particular. They sent me and another designer, Nick Eberle, out to Amsterdam to sit with Guerrilla when they were finishing up Horizon and get some ideas of how they were doing their game, which is a full-on open-world game. They sent Luis and another one of our exploration designers, Ian Miller, up to Sony Bend to take a look at Days Gone and get an idea of how they're doing some of their stuff. So we were able to, like get exposure to these open-world games that are in development with people, you know, who work for the same company we do, get that whole behind the curtains look at things. And I think for me in particular, that time with Guerrilla was extremely beneficial, just looking at how they broke down their quests, where they kind of segmented them into A quests, B quests, C quests, and D quests, not necessarily in terms of quality, but I guess almost the amount of work that would go into it. Where something like a simple fetch quest might fall into like that C quest category, where something with like full cinematics and full VO and encompassing whole levels would fall into that A quest category. So when we were laying out some of exploration, I tried to bucket our quests out into those categories to make sure we had enough of that really good A quest quality stuff for the levels that we needed to service, and then some other stuff to do as well. So like I was saying, like I am really proud of the breadth we have because, you know, we have that really great A-quest stuff, whole levels of content with, you know, that are on par with the main quest of the game. And then, you know, we have other things like that are really strong that kind of fall into that B category. And then there's just tons of stuff to do, whether it's just collecting things, you know, like little precision challenges where I'm, you know, I spot something off in the distance and throw my axe at it, and you know, I get a little reward for that, and just discoverable things that kind of keep you poking around in every nook and cranny and
treasure
looking
maps,
for something. Yeah, I mean,
treasure maps, secret quests.
Yeah,
like there's something for everybody, which is cool. Like the other benefit of like having such a large team is that you can draw from those people and say like, hey, what do you think this? Or well, they'll just come up to you and say like, you know what I loved in X and Y game? This one aspect. Do you think we could do something like that in our game? Like, sure. And we might not be fully on board with it, like myself.
Yeah.
But I know that there's someone out there that likes that.
Right.
There's a demographic for that type of gameplay.
Yeah.
And we'll find a way to work that in.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good point. You know, because we have so many of us invested in this, like, for me in particular, like a treasure map is not something that would get me excited. But there are people who love that stuff.
But
right?
I love them.
Yeah, yeah. Luis loves it. So like you know, it's you can't just design a game for yourself, especially a game like God of War, which, you know, millions of people are going to enjoy. You have to look at a little bit of like what everybody's going to enjoy. And like Luis said, I think there is something for everybody. And, you know, we have this progression economy too with so much you can craft and improve about both Kratos and the Sun, you know, new armors, upgrades to your weapon, you know, different perks and things, way to change your gameplay style. If I'm a more offensive player, there's a path I can go to that. If I find that I'm just taking a lot of hits and I want to bulk up my character, there's a path I can go for that. If I use my weapon specials all the time and I want to like improve my cooldown, there's a path I can go for that. And the more of this exploration content you engage in, the more currency you're going to have to try those different paths and try different things.
Right. All of the exploration content, you know, always feeds back into the main game, into the meta game, and getting resources to craft things, to get new armors, to get new specials. It all feeds into the same system. And that's really exciting.
Yeah. And I think if you are just like a main path player, like you can still, you know, get a little taste of the different things we offer. But to get that full experience, do a little bit of everything, to try everything we have to offer. You got to get into that exploration. You got to try some new things and see what else is out there.
I think rewards are a big thing. Like rewarding the player for exploring was something we found that was like major. yeah, like there was examples where we playtested some content and we didn't have a reward structure built into it.
Right.
and our scores weren't that good. But then as soon as we added like a good reward at the end of that quest, the feedback was different. It's like the scores went up and they're like, yeah, that was awesome. The combat was great, the story was great, and the reward was good.
Mm.
It was worth my time. And
yeah, from a professional standpoint, that has been a really exciting thing. Is this is an established IP, but a lot of what we're doing, so much of what we're doing, is completely new to the franchise. It's just a really exciting challenge. You know, we're laying a lot of foundation for this franchise going forward, which is at the same time terrifying, but also really exciting and challenging in a really good way.
What are your favorite types of quests to make, and what are your favorite types of quests to play?
I think an easy one for everyone is just killing things. So kill quests are popular. In one of the playtests like we had recently, like one kill quest that we had just scored really high, and I was like really surprised. And I was like, wow, people just like killing stuff.
Yeah. I think as a gamer, you know, as designers, sometimes they'll tell us that every gamer can kind of fall into one category. You have people who are just really into experiencing story. There are people who are really into progression, checkboxes, completing things, feeling like there's a sense of accomplishment for what they're doing. There are some people who are just pure killers. They just want to kill stuff. And then there's competitors who just want to be better than their friends. And for me, I think I fall mostly into that progression category. I like the checkboxes and things like that. So really any sort of side content is great for me. I mean, playing other games, I'm the type who goes off and does all the side content before I go and finish the main game, sometimes to a fault where I burn out. And
yeah, I'm the same way. I'm a completionist for sure. So you give me a list.
Yeah.
I'll go through that list.
Love lists. So, and then in terms of like what I enjoy making, like I personally like kind of doing that architecture of the whole thing, like with the quests, you know, it kind of starts off of like, how is this flow going to work? Like when a quest giver is there, like what's the flow he goes through to get you a quest? Does he play a greeting? He call out to you like, hey, over here, I need your help. That leads into an interact, which then leads into a briefing. What are you doing in that briefing? Are you locked down? Can you run away? Is there an interruption? Are there check-in lines? When do I get my reward? When do I go back? Do I have to go back? What's the flow of the quest? I'm a systems designer, so like kind of building the systems is my favorite part. And like we've been saying, like all of this is completely new. So to get all this online, we needed to make a quest system, something the game didn't have before. We needed to make a resource system. We needed to make an armor system and a recipe system. And all that stuff kind of had to be built from the ground up to get to where we are today. So I think that was probably my favorite part.
And for me, it's just the world building aspect of it. You know, so I'm a level designer, and I just love building spaces and having them kind of wrap around each other. So one of my favorite games is Bloodborne. Their designs are just top tier, amazing. So that has been an inspiration for me. And so a lot of the exploration spaces kind of, you know, call back to those games. And we have those little micro loops where you're unlocking paths, unlocking shortcuts. And it's not just for the sake of it, right? Like giving purpose to those paths and giving purpose to those shortcuts. And kind of looping around the space and learning an area, like mentally mapping it, to me is like where I get my thrills.
for systems, like a lot of what a systems designer does is helping other departments. So like I get a lot of enjoyment out of like finding out what these guys need when they're building their spaces and then figuring out a solution, how to make that, you know, better, give them the tools that they need to kind of, you know, make their spaces more engaging or give you more to do in there and kind of creative problem solving together.
Sounds like your job is to kind of like make the game as awesome as possible.
I mean, that's all our job. It's always.
Yeah, that's true. Well, thank you guys so much for sitting down.
Yeah, it's cool. Great talking to you. Thank you. Yeah.